Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie that they didn't make. I'm Norm Willner, the senior film writer for Now Magazine, and welcome to the show. Or welcome back, if you're a regular listener. Turns out we have those. Oh, and regular listeners will be happy to find out that there will be a bonus episode this week. Not a Splintersode, but a whole new episode dropping later this week. Come back for it. My guest this week is Ari Millen, whom you may recognize as several different characters on Orphan Black. He plays Mark, Rudy, Miller, Seth, and several other clones from the Caster line, and as such, he's been the principal adversary on the show this year. With the third season finale airing this Saturday, June 19th, it seemed like the right time to have him on the show. Ari's choice was The Believer, Henry Bean's 2001 drama starring Ryan Gosling as Daniel, a fervent New York neo-Nazi whose hate-mongering and violence are made much more complex by the fact that he himself is Jewish. It's a bit of a tricky sell. Bean made some stylistic choices that don't always work, but Gosling is absolutely mesmerizing in what remains one of his most complex and powerful performances. Seriously, if it had gone straight from winning the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance into theatrical release, it would have put him on track for his first Oscar nomination. But that's not exactly how things went. Distribution issues were a thing, there were some other issues, 9/11 happened, and ultimately The Believer made its premiere on cable in the US, eventually emerging theatrically and then on DVD, but sort of missing its mass audience. Not that it would have ever been a huge hit, I suspect, but a lot more people would have seen it, and I think the heat would have driven Gosling even faster into prominence than ended up happening anyway. Anyway, we'll get to that. This is someone else's movie. Everybody's choices always surprise me. They're always small personal movies that people make connections to. So what was the connection here? Why did you go for The Believer?
Good question. And I don't think I really know the answer full, but it was always a movie. I saw this movie probably for the first time just after it had been released, maybe like, let's say 2003, 2004. That was the first time I saw it on I went to the movie store and rented it. And I hadn't seen it until 2 days ago.
Right.
Again.
Yeah, I had a similar gap. I went out and found it again. I think I probably saw it in 2003.
Yeah.
And not since.
Exactly.
Until yesterday.
So it was very interesting for me to rediscover, all right, this is why I remember liking this movie so much. But then at the same point, you can't not mature and change over that period of time.
Sure.
And so things that I probably liked it for then have now shifted, and now why I appreciate it is similar but different. So, but it was, I mean, I think it's one of those things, it's like I have a list of Blu-rays that I want to buy and I want to own, and none of them have been printed on Blu-ray yet. They're all still on DVD, and The Believer is, for me, has been on that list. I don't know if it has been now.
Never been released anywhere in the world.
So, and then doing a little bit of the research about it, it was very interesting for the very reason why it might not have been released. So,
well, because what I had looked for Blu-ray wise, I wasn't surprised that The Believer isn't out, because the distribution are such a tangle for that film. It's been available and unavailable. It's on certain streaming level, certain streaming services, and not on others. And I'm not even sure it ever got released in Canada, really.
From what I saw, it was at Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
It won. It won
the Grand Jury Prize.
Grand Jury Prize, and then it was scheduled for theatrical release, or at least art house,
mm-hmm.
Movie theaters. And then 9/11 happened, and it got canned. And then after that, it couldn't find a distributor. Yeah. And so it wasn't until 2002 or 2003 that it got released on TV.
Yeah, it played on American cable before theatrical,
which
is less common even now.
I had never even heard of that.
It happened once in a while, mostly with documentaries, I think, just because there'd be some sort of production stipulation where, paid for this, we get to air it first.
Yeah.
Like, even now we have Going Clear playing Canadian theaters while it's been on HBO for months in the States, but not here, just because of the way that the funding was worked out there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, The Believer was, Like, it's in a really weird way that's almost suited to the film itself. It's this bastard child thing where no one really knows what to do with it.
Fair enough.
And it keeps moving around and it's slippery.
And it's controversial, just like the character.
Yeah, it's hard to pin down. But the other thing that amazes me now watching it is how, like, fully formed Gosling is. Like, it's that performance is so volatile and incandescent and cruel and vicious, but also so needy, really. Like, mm-hmm. he's emotionally so raw in a way that a lot of other actors might not necessarily be, but it just seems to come so naturally to him. But I can also see someone trying to figure out, like, how the hell do you sell this? What do you say it's about?
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of stunting its growth or its chances before you even get to the religious aspect of it, which is, again, a powder keg on its own.
Yeah, I mean, and back to, you know, why I chose it.
Mm-hmm.
There are two actors that, you know, I don't know if the right word is envy or if I'm jealous of, but it's essentially performance after performance. I just watch them and I'm just in awe of it and then envious or jealous that they did it and not me. And I'll never be able to do it as good as they did because they did it and that's why I love it. And Gosling is one of them. And I think probably the first time The Believer was probably my first introduction to him.
I would think, like, what else was there that time? Until The Notebook, he didn't really burst out.
Right.
So, yeah, other than his television work, which gives you no hint at all. It gives you a sense of his playfulness, but nothing of the intensity that he brings to the role.
I think I didn't know who he was again until, what was he? He was nominated for an Oscar in 2006.
Is it Half Nelson?
Teacher, Half Nelson.
Yeah, which is also not on Blu-ray, which kind of stunned me.
He's so charming.
Yeah.
And again, it's the same kind of thing. It's just like he's living two lives. And what they're kind of secret from each other in Half Nelson.
Yeah.
In the same, The Believer is much more overt.
Yeah.
But the struggle is much more internal, whereas, you know, he's able to hide it in Half Nelson. But yeah.
Well, Half Nelson, he's literally a functional addict. I mean, that's the definition of his character, who still manages to do good in people's lives, even though he's got a crippling crack addiction. And in The Believer, he's not interested in doing good at all, although it does keep happening, which is really fascinating. That's the part of the narrative that I just come back to. Last night, I'm trying to remember in my head, and I was like, oh, that's right, I don't remember why the first bomb doesn't go off, but there's never really an explanation. And you can believe that he fully intends for malice and malevolence to mm-hmm. occur, and that that's what he desperately wants. But ultimately, like, he wants something else, which is what the film plays out so beautifully, and which we'll get to. I don't want to.
I think he does want that first bomb to go off, and I think we're seeing him rediscover that part of himself as the movie goes on. And so, the fact that it didn't go off, he's now past that point of wanting it to go off.
Right.
Right? Like if it had happened, he would have been okay with it. But it didn't go off, and from there he had taken the Torah home with him, and now he's closer to where he came from.
Yeah. It's a remarkable dramatic arc for a character who is introduced as just nothing but, like, loathsome.
Mm-hmm.
He's a hateful human being, barely a human being. He's existing on that sort of instinctive, rebellious, violent aspect of consciousness, which isn't even necessary. Like, he moves like a shark. He targets a guy and beats a Hasidic youth. Like, the kid's a kid. He's younger than Gosling is, and Gosling's only 19 or 20 when he shot the film. He's introduced at this point, and then very, very quickly and with surprising force, the movie establishes who he really is. It's the kind of thing, like, I suppose we should roll back and explain, just in case people haven't seen this and are still listening. Every episode of someone else's movie comes with the proviso that you really should have seen the movie before you start watching this. So pause, go find Netflix, and then come back and we'll play the rest.
I don't even think it's on Netflix.
It's on US Netflix, I checked.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which I think is hackable from Canada with the Hola Unblocker extension for Google Chrome, although you didn't hear it. It's still a subscription-based service. I pay the same $8.99 wherever I am.
It's the geo-blocking that's the issue.
But there's so much other stuff. But the premise of The Believer is actually lifted from a true story in 1965 of a an active neo-Nazi and an aggressive anti-Semite, was exposed by the New York Times as being Jewish, as having been born and raised in Bar Mitzvah, and he killed himself the day the story ran.
Yeah.
This is not that. This takes the concept of it and leaps into a completely new story, mm-hmm. set in 1990, set in 2000, rather, in the present day, where the character that Gosling plays is a rabid anti-Semite and an expert arguer and just a remarkable debater of anything, but also the...
Which, kind you know, of, you can argue that he learned in...
At the yeshiva, yeah, exactly. So you've got the platonic ideal of the self-hating Jew, which is always what I assume that Henry Bean made the movie to demonstrate. It's like, you know, when a Jewish person speaks out against Israel or policy or anything religious, he or she is immediately labeled self-hating, because that's obviously why you're coming back and you don't like yourself. That's why you attack the religion. I get this fairly often just because I have opinions. But... Mm-hmm. This is that writ large. This is the worst case scenario of a self-hating Jew, which is someone who has so internalized his own disgust with his religious structure and tenets and the way he was educated that he has turned to violence and is actively preaching violence against his own people, although it's not that simple either.
No, I mean, like, the way I saw it was, like, he was a boy who had very strong and very valid opinions about interpretation of the Bible, and they didn't fit with the school. The school kept telling him, no, you're wrong, and essentially drove him out. So he almost got ostracized from his people based on his beliefs, when all it really takes is it's a discussion. And that's, I think, all he was looking for, was to have a good discussion. And it's like, why are we always perpetuating the same belief? This is a valid opinion. Let's talk about this and let's find the middle ground, not it's black or white. Yeah. So he's ostracized. And then it goes further to, you know, as part of, him and his skin buddies get in a fight. And they can either do 30 days in jail or they can do sensitivity training. Right. And so
which is pretty funny for 2000 as well. Like, now it's just laughable, but the idea that might have helped then is remarkable. But.
So they sit down in a room with Holocaust survivors, and the Holocaust survivors are telling their story, which are very powerful things. And one of the gentlemen recounts a story of they're discovered and pulled out of a hayloft.
Trying to be exactly past a checkpoint in Germany, but they got
caught. And his 3-year-old son starts to cry because he's scared, and he reaches out to grab his son to comfort him, not to like take him away from the German, but just like look to reassure him that he's there. And the sergeant comes around and impales the 3-year-old child on his bayonet, lifts him over his head as the blood falls down on his father's head. And then drops him and says, "You can have him back now."
Yeah.
And
which almost plays like a parable. I mean, it's sort of mirrored in the story of Abraham and Isaac, which is what the movie uses as its dramatic hook.
As in the flashbacks to young Daniel fighting this his main argument.
Inflexible rabbi. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, Gosling character says, "Well, why didn't you do anything?" It's like, "Well, you weren't there. He would have been shot." And Gosling's character, and this to me is like, you know, like it rings such truth, and which gives such validity to Gosling's character's thrust of, well, I'm not proud of, you know, I'm just not proud of who my people are because we lay down.
Yeah.
And like, why didn't you do something? Well, you weren't there. You don't know. You wouldn't have done, you know, you don't know what it's like. It was like, they would have killed him. It's like, well, at least he would have died trying to save his child, attacking the man who killed him, instead of being less than nothing now.
Yeah.
And he leaves the scene, you know, like, well, what would, you know, what can you teach us? He gets up and he says, these people have nothing to teach us. And one of the survivors, you know, says, well, what can you teach us? And he says, kill your enemy, and walks out. And it's this, the movie for me has this, it's really interesting how it can, it just lives in a gray area, and you're not living on these are the good people and these are the bad people, and you have to believe everything that the good people say and you hate everything the bad people say. It's like, what's so compelling about it is that everybody has valid points and that there is no right answer. Yeah. And that's the struggle and the journey that we're watching his character go through.
Yeah. And most of these films will inevitably, you know, you think of every after school special you've ever seen that dealt with racial or religious issues. And there's always somebody outside of it, a friend of a friend who says, oh, you know, the real thing to do here is just to be yourself. And this, like, being himself would be the worst possible thing.
Uh-huh.
He's our beacon because he's the main character and he's the person the film has chosen to trap us with. But yeah, that scene also has this incredible exchange between Gosling and Garrett Dillahunt about how, you know, like the Holocaust didn't happen. And he just starts immediately trying to discredit it and spouts out, oh, only 200. And first of all, Garrett Dillahunt, what the hell? I didn't even notice that was him the first time. I guess I didn't know
there's
who he
a
was.
Lot of people in that movie,
but,
that,
yeah.
There's,
and he's great. Like, he's vivid. And
he probably went, I think he went right on to be like one of the.
Deadwood wasn't far away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Two of the most incredible characters in Deadwood.
Yeah. And he just fully disappears into this role with that dead eyed thing he does so well and spouts out, you know, well, only 200,000 Jews maximum died. And then Gosling turns it on him and says, but Hitler's your hero, right? Like, how can he be your hero if he didn't do this thing?
Yeah, if he had death camps all over Europe and only managed to kill 200,000 Jews, how is he a hero?
Yeah.
You want him to have killed 6 million because that's an accomplishment.
Yeah, it exposes the fallacy of that argument, the Holocaust, of negating the Holocaust to that's some sort of larger profit scheme, which comes up every now and then in the real world, which is horrifying. But it also shows you how much Danny Gosling's character relishes the fight. Like, he just wants to be right about everything, but he's also pretty much going to be because he's done the work. Like, he even says at some point, even though his yeshiva training, the fact that he reads and speaks Hebrew, that's not something he's necessarily might have done had he been given the opportunity to pass on it. But he says, you know, like, oh yeah, I know all this stuff, and it does make him a better opponent. Like, that's the
worst
thing about it.
How can you hate your enemy if you don't know anything about them?
Exactly. Yeah. And then that brings in one of the more awkward plot arcs, which is that he ends up teaching the daughter of a fascist financier to read and perhaps become fascinated by the Bible or the Torah specifically, and basically just so she can be in a certain position in a certain place at the last act. But a lot of that happens in the movie, and I'm willing to overlook so much of it because
I think from the first when I first watched it when I was in my early 20s to now watching it and live my life and had certain experiences, I was doing some reading about Henry Bean, and he's Jewish, and I'm using quotation marks, he's Jewish kind of in the way that I'm Jewish, in that he's Jewish, but, and he uses the word assimilated, and I wouldn't say assimilated.
I tend to go with culturally myself.
Yeah.
Like, I appreciate Delhi, and I know just enough Hebrew to recognize it when Sacha Baron Cohen is speaking it in Borat.
I mean, I grew up in Kingston, and I don't even think there's a synagogue, structure
right.
of a synagogue there. So I wouldn't say my family was assimilated. We were just
around.
We were around, and I always knew it was part of. It was from my mother's side, and we had Hanukkah. We also had Christmas. Like it was, like, so it was a very Jewish light upbringing. And then I used to watch a lot of A&E with my dad. So conversely, at that point in time, World War II shows were all that was played on A&E.
They hadn't discovered Law and Order reruns.
Exactly. So I don't know. I wouldn't call it unhealthy, but I certainly had a very strong attraction to World War I, but mostly World War II, and just being very interested in this, in whatever this was. And I guess it's, you know, who are these people that hated my people so much, even though I had no real affiliation with who those people were and in the same way.
It's like a fable being told to you. And that's the thing that my school didn't get, because they would show us footage of the camps when we were kids once a year. And it's just like, remember, and it's like, okay, but I can't comprehend the scale of this thing. It's so, you understand it when you, like, if you ever get to Europe and you just, there are memorials everywhere. There are all kinds of things. Yeah. I went to Vienna and was just stunned at how much, statuary there was and plaques and things, that this is the thing that you're not allowed to forget because it really physically happened there.
Yeah.
And here it's just, yeah, it's a thing you see in old documentaries. It's mm-hmm. it's a canard that's brought up.
With another issue that I read about Henry Bean was that this sort of Disneyfying of the Holocaust,
yeah.
that he hated Schindler's List, he hated Roberto.
Please say Life is Beautiful.
Life is Beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, even though they're individual stories within Holocaust as a whole, the Holocaust doesn't have a happy ending.
Mm.
Period.
Yeah.
And so he hated the fact that Hollywood was now creating this industry of the Holocaust. And it's really interesting because I went to, I did March of the Living, which for what people don't know, there's these two programs that I did Birthright.
Right.
So,
I did that too.
So, and I can, you know what? I'll get to that.
Sure.
So growing up in Kingston, not really having a sense of being Jewish, the only sort of idea I had was hockey locker room, people identifying me as Jewish.
Okay.
So that, like, sort of, it was always in a negative way. Like, I mean, as much as my family supported it, it was, you only really care about what your peers think. So, you know, just being singled out in the hockey locker room as the Jew, which now means nothing to me. Mm-hmm. But at that point, when you just want people to like you, it really meant something, and it really frustrated me. So I had this really negative sort of association with being Jewish, kind of like, you know, like Danny did. So I did Birthright.
And that's the trip to Israel.
That's the trip to this great program that brings Jews to Israel for on a free 10-day trip.
Right.
And get to experience it. So I did that. And all of a sudden, you know, I started to see, because I didn't have a lot of Jewish friends growing up. So all of a sudden I had these, was exclusively with all these Jewish kids from Toronto or from, you know, around Canada and also around the world, because everyone goes around the same time. And was meeting them. I was like, and I was getting positive reinforcement of my people. And then a couple of years later, I did March of the Living, which you go to Poland first.
Right.
And you get to see, as you say, you know, Europe, you don't get to forget because it happened there.
Yeah.
So you go everywhere around Poland to and Auschwitz, and back to what Henry Bean was saying. You mean it's not super overt, but outside of the gates, there's a concession stand.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like, that rubs people. I mean, people got to eat, right? And once you're in there, unless you brought a bag lunch, you're not going to be able to eat.
Right.
But it's like people have the one criticism, and you kind of look at it and kind of feel icky, is like people are making money off of the tourist industry of something that was that came from the Holocaust,
right, yeah.
Which I guess is also his, along the same lines as Schindler's List and Life is Beautiful, where it's like people are making money off of something that, you know, and putting a positive spin in the end that to make you feel good.
Yeah.
It's like, no.
It's a really weird place to be because, like, I think Schindler's List is the film where you have the excuse of this actually did happen, these people did survive, and this is how and why.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell that story and masterfully and still have an ending that makes you kind of appreciate the endurance of everyone who went through it. And then you have that scene at the end, the mm-hmm. genius scene of every of the actual survivors, so people can't even deny that
mm-hmm.
it's a Hollywood fabrication. These are the real people. Life is Beautiful, I despise. I just, mm-hmm. I found it, it's awful. It's just this, the shameless recontextualization of a horrific, almost inconceivable tragedy in order to let Roberto Benigni kiss a girl and come out looking like a hero.
Yeah.
Even though his character doesn't make it out, it's still heroic. He still didn't have the balls to kill himself on camera. He does it off screen. It's like, oh, yeah. we can do that for a while. I'm kind of hoping someone does pick a Benigni film to talk to on the show at one point. But yeah, after Schindler's List, a number of projects suddenly became viable and were all put into production.
Sure.
The Believer definitely feels like the answer to those.
Yeah.
Like the response.
Yeah. And it was something he was like, so back to how I'm like, how I, when I was reading about him and his experience, like, it's just like, he kind of felt, he didn't really have the connection, but had a connection to it. and was kind of really put off by this sub genre that was being created. And what attracts me to Danny or Gosling's character is this just sort of struggle. And just I don't know if you could name a better anti-hero. I mean, he's got to be one of the quintessential anti-heroes you'll ever see on film. It's just like you're rooting for him, but you hate everything he stands for. But things he say make so much sense, and they really sort of spark conversations in my head about, okay, I had thoughts, you know. As much as you know, you don't want to label, you don't want to be self-hating Jew, and you don't want to think that a neo-Nazi can be right. It's just like
you don't want to come away thinking, oh, he does have some very valid points.
But these are all thoughts that I kind of had. And in the same way that he talks about, you know, first we'll kill one or two Jews, and people won't know why, but they won't say anything because deep down inside they'll be like, yeah. That's what I want. And I mean, that's not what I'm saying about me, but things he's saying about Israelis aren't Jews because they have soil.
Yeah, his whole argument about land, it's insane on its face.
Yeah.
But it is seductive. Like, that's the thing that Gosling does so much so seduction. He lures you in. He brings you in. And he speaks with the authority of someone much older, because he is just a kid.
Mm-hmm. Henry Bean had been sitting on the story for 25 years.
Yeah.
So maybe that's why there's so much perspective.
I'm sure.
In Gosling's character.
Chewed over and worked around.
Yeah.
And every single argument has an answer in the scene. And the balance is never entirely guaranteed. Like, Gosling, he believes he's always right. But the film shows us fairly often that he's either not completely grounded in whatever it is he's doing, or he's dead wrong and he's just found a room that likes it. But we get to watch him not be confronted with that because he's so secure in his convictions until the end, when he tries something that's genuinely original in terms of its argument.
And it's brilliant.
And it is incredible, right?
Yes.
And it dies in the room.
Yeah.
And you can see the actor stumbling and reacting and trying to figure out, or the character.
Yeah.
But Gosling does it with this incredible, like, he's always on the verge of tears, but you can't tell if he's going to cry out of guilt or grief or rage or anger.
Yeah.
And it's,
yeah.
Yeah. You can't,
even when he's beating up the kid at the beginning.
Yeah. Something is
the same thing in his eyes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I mean, I've had the chance to interview him a number of times, and he's incredibly playful and light, and he refuses. Like, it takes 10 minutes every single time to get a serious answer out of him, because he'll just deflect and be silly. And talked about Gangster Squad on the junket for that. I asked the question about the voice, but other people had asked him other questions, and he just refused to take anything seriously. And it's like, he pitches his voice really high in Gangster Squad, like an octave higher than normal, kind of like this for no particular reason.
Oh, really?
And it's like, he figured that it would be what the guy was doing to emulate a 40s gangster movie character.
Oh,
like,
interesting.
He thinks that sells him better in the character's mind.
Yeah.
And Gosling knows how wrong and weird it is, but it's fascinating. Like, he's the most interesting thing in the moment.
In A Place Between the Pines, when he was robbing the bank, he let his... this is something that I remember now that you're bringing this up.
Yeah.
He let his voice, when he was screaming, crack and go really high, which is really interesting too.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that he also did that again.
He's incredible with his voice. He does all kinds of stuff. And Place Beyond the Pines, those scenes, that robbery was shot in one take.
Oh, really?
And they did a number of them. Like, I think they spent 2 days shooting it.
Okay.
So the first time they did it, this is one of the other interviews I did with him, the first time they did the interview, the robbery sequence, the first take is a single take. He drives up on the motorcycle, comes in, waves his gun around, jumps the glass, does all that stuff, and no one was scared. Everybody was looking at him going, great job, like, just smiling back at him. They're not visible on camera. But he said, you just have to make it more violent and go bigger. And I think he blew his voice out. I think that's
what happens. Okay, so it wasn't a choice. It just sort of happened.
Or he went with it every time.
Oh,
he just let it happen.
Beautiful. But, I mean, for me, I was like, this, and this is, again, jealous or envy. I don't know which the right term is, but it's just like, it's just like, wow, I'm just impressed with him.
Yeah,
he's just so great.
He's a really remarkable actor. He's one of those people too who I just kind of fascinated in watching him not be a movie star. Like, he fights it all the time. He makes eccentric choices and strange, decides to make Lost River, which is a directorial effort. He wrote and directed this movie about how much he loves David Lynch and Mario Bava.
Oh, really?
And Dario Argento. Yeah, and nobody knew what to do with it. It's out. It's on disc now, but it's this, like, you can't say that it isn't exactly what he wanted to put on screen. And even in his like first major film role in The Believer, he's almost untested dramatically. He's only done Young Hercules and Breaker mm-hmm. High and a lot mm-hmm. of disposable Pretty Boy stuff, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is probably why he picked this.
Yeah, and he just kills it. He's yeah. like, not only is he a natural, but he owns that role from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he even knows how to tilt his head right. To just be, like, you can accomplish it with photography, but there are certain innate aspects of that performance that are scarily natural mm-hmm. for him.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I've been alone in a room with him talking about stuff and not a trace of any of it. The control he has is fantastic. And mm-hmm. when he gets excited about something, there's definitely, you know, a liveliness to him. Like, he told me a story about how Drive got made. And it was basically, he described it as a bad date between him and Nicholas Winding Refn. They went out for dinner and Refn didn't drive, so Gosling had to pick him up and take him to this restaurant in L.A., and they were sitting there, and they had a really awkward conversation. It wasn't very good, and at the end of it, it's just like, he said, like, oh, nobody's getting laid tonight. This isn't happening. This movie's not coming together, and we have no chemistry, no electricity, and they drove off, and because Refn doesn't drive, he had to drive him home. So they've had this dinner where nothing went right, and they didn't connect, and they're sitting together, and they're stopped at a light, and there's a song on the radio, and Refn just starts banging on the dashboard and saying, this is what I feel about the movie, this is what the movie is, and he's like, and Gosling's like, oh, that's all you had to say, well, let's do this, this is exactly what I want to do. And then Drive comes out as a result of that.
Wow.
Which is, again, he speaks like 100 words in the whole picture, and
yeah.
it's all physical carriage and
yeah.
body tricks. He's yeah it's all in The Believer, like all of it is there, his entire future as an actor. Right,
two more with him, or one more with him?
Only God Forgives, and I think they're working on something now. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But all of these
17 words.
Yeah, probably. And most of them are mom.
Yeah.
but yeah, all of it is in The Believer. Like, he's fully formed as an actor, which is what's so remarkable. Yeah. That performance comes out of nowhere. And I think maybe even more than the religious aspect or the political aspect, I'm kind of wondering if on some level people weren't willing to distribute it or pick it up or promote it as much at the time because it feels too real. Like, it almost feels, you had said there was a concern that people might take it seriously as an endorsement.
Yeah, I some of the back reading I did on it, there was, I guess, one rabbi who sort of was the go-to rabbi, Rabbi Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
I think his name is, was sort of the Hollywood go-to rabbi, and if he didn't give it his stamp of approval, then it wouldn't get passed on, and he didn't like it. And a lot of the reviews I was reading, I had to stop reading the reviews because I agreed with a lot of what was being said in these reviews, but at the same time, it's like, no, I still like this movie, and I'm not gonna let it be spoiled by, you know, them picking apart this and picking apart this, which I agree with, but in the end, that's not the important part. The important part is Gosling's performance and his character arc, and that's all I care about. Mm. And that's all anyone should care about, because it's incredible story of only him. But a lot of the criticism and fear was because he was so articulate, because his character was so articulate, because he was raising some very valid points, that this would just add fuel to the fire of people who didn't know any better.
Right.
Which, fair. I mean, like I said, I'm a quotation marks in the air. I'm Jewish. I'm certainly more Jewish now than I was growing up. But I'm not as Jewish as someone who lives at Bathurst and Lauren, like, yeah. So who's their full on identity, and they understand it, and they've dealt with more prosecution and more racism than I ever will in my life.
Yeah, sure.
So I can't defend, or I can't attack their position that of them saying no, that this is wrong. But people who want to hate are going to hate, and they're going to find a reason. And I think what's important about this movie is that it lives in a gray area where there is nobody is right and nobody is wrong. And I think, you know, the whole thesis of it, what it comes down to is, if you aren't open to discussion, if you just sort of say, no, this, if you create walls on either side and don't meet face to face and don't talk, then it's never going to change. So it is very important to discuss. And just because you don't agree with the other person's opinion doesn't mean that they don't have valid things to say, just the way that what you have to say is very valid.
Yeah. Well, and it goes to the classic argument against any piece of culture, which is, you know, like, this will incite violence. This will make people desecrate a synagogue or kick over cemetery headstones or you know, punch people in the street. But no piece of culture can do that. The person still has to make the decision. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can be tilted in a direction, but I don't think anybody blames the Dark Knight Rises for the guy who shot up a movie theater that was playing it. That's where a lot of people will be, yes, but it's not that Batman did it. Mm-hmm. The argument that the believer is, like, because it's ambiguous, and it really isn't in the end. I mean, I think it's pretty clear what choices are made and how the story is told.
And there was misinformation, right? They were like, a lot of the concern was, you threw the Torah on the floor and you stepped on it. And he's like, Henry Bean was like, no.
Yeah.
We took great care to make sure that that part of that scene is not actually the Torah.
Sure, like, of course.
Yeah. But, of course, that gets out there and the information spreads and all of a sudden everyone's up in arms about that.
Yeah, plus if you want that to be the story, you will make it the story. Like, if you are out to kind of sabotage the release of the film and I heard it does this, you won't say, I heard it does this. You'll say, it does this. And it doesn't, because it's a movie and none of it is real. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, it's like arguing for...
It's news opinion, not news.
Yeah, yeah, and it's just shout it, really. Yeah. It's whoever shouts the loudest wins. That's how that works. Yeah. And it's still how it works. I'm kind of amazed to find it floating around, the film floating around now, for streaming and available on disc, because I figured it would just sort of be one of those things that quietly gets swept away.
It probably would have, if it weren't Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a big part of it. I would say it's a star-making performance, but in the rearview mirror, every one of his first films is a star-making performance. And the Ryan Gosling of The Believer is somehow not the Ryan Gosling of The Notebook, which was only 3 years later, but it's the same guy.
Like, and it's so interesting to see, and we were talking about this, how he's evolved as an actor, but how, where he came from, and it was always there, but how he's refined it and changed but can go back and can change his voice. He could do this, but it's just like, and it's so, ingrained in him. He always had it.
Yeah, he really
Where some
does.
People have to work at it, which I think has been my journey, especially at 21. There's no way I could, or 18 or 19 or whatever, how old he was when he did that. There's no way I could have pulled that off, which is why I'm envious / jealous.
Well, so that brings us to the other key question of the show, which is that how or what have you used? What have you from the... Is there anything in The Believer that you've pulled on? I mean, I just on Orphan Black alone, there's some elements of... Like, Mark is a little bit Goslingy, I would say, of just the intensity and the focus and the way you kind of... He almost never moves his head is a really precise physical thing that none of the other characters you've played in the show do. And I'm really interested in that because that was the first character you played on the show.
Yeah.
And watching him stay the same while other variations have arrived has been really interesting. I mean, we're only 6 episodes in, and please, for the love of God, don't tell me anything else. But it's but there are certain things that reminded me just watching last week's episode. Once you told me this is the movie you wanted to do, it's just like, oh, I can sort of see that, and might just be backfilling that myself. But is there something in the movie that you've
interestingly enough. I mean, I think the anti-hero is the most interesting character for me. I think that's what I'm naturally drawn to. I would love to play that for the rest of my life. And certainly, when I got cast in season 2 as Mark, for me, I definitely saw a danger of him just sort of falling into a two-dimensional sort of right-hand man to the baddie.
Hmm. Yeah,
and I wasn't, and I'm not interested in that, and I wasn't going to let it happen. And thankfully, the writer's room on Orphan Black is organic and will go with what the actors are bringing, and they won't force it on you. So I always try to find the other side of the actor, of the character.
Sure.
It's generally what I try to do. It's not always possible, but, you know, thankfully this season on Orphan Black with the many incarnations of Project Caster, I've got to explore many parts of my personality but also try to find the other opposite side of their personality. Mm-hmm. So back to The Believer, I was watching Gosling just as this sort of intensely tough, confident guy And I was like, I wish I had seen this before I started with Rudy.
Okay.
Because there are certain things I would have loved to have stole. I think there were certain things that I always saw. I always saw Rudy as a certain guy. And then when I saw Gosling pull this off, I'm like, and that's the perfect way to articulate. Like, it was like, yeah. Oh, just like, it's just like, it's the subtleties in his performance. I'm like, that's fantastic. Like, I mean, I'm just like, wow. But and also at the same time, it's probably good that I didn't, because I don't want to copy anybody, and I want want Rudy to be his own creation. But for Mark, certainly, the danger of just being the two-dimensional sort of sidekick, bad guy, just carrying out all the bad things. But for me, I was always just looking for certain things that could soften him. And also, what was really interesting to me was, I always thought of him having two different personas. He had the in-town persona, where we first meet him at the diner with Sarah.
Yeah.
Where his Project Caster training, although we didn't know, I had no idea about that back then. He had his in-town sort of intensity. And then when he came back to the compound with Johansson, he was this lost boy,
mm-hmm.
who was just looking for, to belong, which in sort of my formation and the stuff I had heard before is one of the ways that neo-Nazi groups attract people. You know, they'll either provide family, they'll provide girls, they'll provide violence. Like, they'll just they'll figure out what it is that this lost kid, what appeals to him, and then they'll just give it to him in excess and just win him in.
Yeah, well, it's a cult of abundance, right?
Yeah.
Come to us and we provide whatever you need.
Exactly, and that's sort of how I saw how Mark got attracted and pulled into the Prolethians. Was he was just this lost soul who found what he was looking for. And now in this season, we learned that he was planted there, mm-hmm. by Project Caster, but it still works for me, because he was always lacking that father figure.
Yeah.
Because he had his mother, but he never had his father.
Yeah.
And so, and now he found Johansson, who was this captivating man who showed him all the love that he wished he had, and now he wasn't one of many. He was himself.
Right. And of course, it makes perfect, like, emotional sense that an actual functional family, even though they're not functional in the least,
right.
would be an attractor for him, just because, yeah, he's only known one type of existence, and it was kind of homogenous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, and that's kind of the way I developed Mark. I was like, he's got his in-town, and then he's got on the ranch persona, where it's just like these two different sides, and that for me was really interesting to play.
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully it pulled they went with it.
Yeah, it works out. So as far as the Believer goes, would you, like, where do you see it fitting in now, and in like, how would you try to sell this to somebody, because people will hopefully go and look for it right now, or if they haven't already, what would your, like, it comes back to my first question, is how do you sell a movie like this? What's the hook?
I mean, it's just a power. I mean, I don't think anyone needs to be convinced that Gosling is a great actor, and that he's just one of the generations. He's like,
yeah,
he's one of those new. He, I don't know. Him and Tom Hardy can do no wrong by me. But it's just, forget about the movie and just watch his performance. And it's just one of the best performances you will see, and it's and you will kind of see the beginning of where he is now, which I think did the beginning of his journey, which is really interesting, because from the movies he's been able to make since then.
Yeah. It's kind of hard to imagine he's been working for 15 years off that. Like, it's just been that long. It's that far in the rear view.
And now you've probably been working 10 years before that too.
Yeah. Theater kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're not like us. My thanks to Ari Millen, who I'm assured plays a considerable role in the season finale of Orphan Black this Saturday night, June 19th. It'll air on Space in Canada and BBC America in the US. You can find him on Twitter at Ari Millen, ARIMILLEN. Now, as we said, The Believer is a little harder to find. It's streaming on Netflix in the US, but if you're in Canada, you'll have to do a little work to watch it here. It's also on iTunes and Google Play in the States. but not here. In Canada, the best way to see the movie is to find one of the original, less-than-great DVDs released by Palm Pictures way back. Let's hope it finds its way into the Criterion Collection one of these days. You can find me online at Norm Wilner on Twitter and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, or at someoneelsesmovie.com. If you want to leave a review up on iTunes, that'd be cool. We got a new one last week, and that was nice. And don't forget, extra episode dropping later this week. You'll want to come back for that. And thanks for listening.
All of us, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.